On the 28th of June, 1969, on a hot night in Greenwich Village, New York, trouble erupted in a bar called the Stonewall Inn. It was a hub for the local queer community of largely disadvantaged people and was subjected to frequent police raids. Homosexuality was still illegal in America at the time. The community were closeted and downtrodden. But during the police raid on this night, something changed. They fought back. Many people credit this with being the birth of the modern LGBTQ movement. Marguerite, a teenager living in New York at the time, gives us a flavour of those bars and the climate of fear.
Dive bars, nasty places that were dark and dirty and in back streets, and they had watered down drinks at very high prices, and of course the risk that if the raid happened that you'd be arrested. And the fear of that became so bad that there was an incident not very long before the Stonewall riots, in fact, maybe only a few weeks before, where a young Hispanic man was in such terror of having been arrested that he jumped out the window of a police station and ended up impaled on the railings. And that was something that was lighting the flames that actually blew up on that night at Stonewall.
Marguerite goes on to recount how she heard the news of the riot.
I had graduated from high school literally the day before. So that Saturday, I was home relaxing, and it was literally too hot to do anything but hang around at home. So I had the radio on in the background when news came through that there was what they were describing as a riot in Greenwich Village, and that it was centering on a gay bar, and that the police were being attacked by a small crowd. At the time, I was 17 years old, and I was already involved with the anti-Vietnam War movement. And so I was very pleased to hear the news, because somehow in New York, you know, particularly if you're curious or knew back in those days, that the mafia were very much in control of minority bars, and that the protection money that they charged gay bars was actually protection against the mafia itself, not actually the police, because the police still would raid and create havoc, and people lived in dread of having criminal records because they wouldn't take jobs. It could literally ruin somebody's life. So I was basically saying, yes, go. I thought it was a great thing.
Jamie, living in Los Angeles, already knew she was queer. She tells us how that felt.
I just remember just being frozen in front of the television. So I think I was meant to be taking out the trash or doing something like that, when I just stopped and just, I was frozen. I was scared. I was angry. And I was hurt. And I think what multiplied at that very moment was my mother's homophobic remarks. You know, it was things, well, she did the same thing about civil rights movement, you know, and it's a shame because she was just brainwashed. Normally a really nice woman, really compassionate and empathetic. But when it came to, you know, gays and blacks and Jews, she wasn't having it. So I had to deflect. I was just deflecting the whole time, while in my own private moment of grief.
The political landscape in America at the time was alive with activism. Huge numbers of people were involved in struggles for civil rights. Martin Luther King had been assassinated the year before, and the Vietnam War was claiming many young lives. Stonewall was pivotal in escalating the fight for LGBTQ rights and also in beginning to shape the community that we have today, which is why many people consider it as the birth of the modern LGBTQ movement. However, it arose within a climate of striving for human rights and from historical contexts of more conservative but important political lobbying over many years. Marguerite highlights this background.
We paid an awful lot of dues so that the younger people of today can feel the freedom to walk along holding hands. It did not start.
It wasn't with just Stonewall. A spontaneous birth of a movement. There was a context behind it. The scene had been set over quite a number of years, because there were already gay organizations that we would recognize as such. Back in the early 60s, even the late 50s, and there were people who were working quietly towards various demands for rights, but specifically within the law.
The eruption at Stonewall set off a tidal wave within the community, with the formation of the Gay Liberation Front at the London School of Economics in October 1970. The GLF sought new rights through a campaign of visibility and public activism, rather than through traditional political avenues. There was also a long history of political lobbying in the UK, and homosexuality had been partially decriminalised in 1967. But the law did not permit people to meet outside their homes, and there was a lot of police harassment and arrests. Frankie, living in London, expresses how society viewed gay people at the time and the impact of this.
There was that kind of defining of lesbians and gay men as mentally ill, and also as being kind of freaks, really. We were sort of, you know, not safe to be around children, and we were not fit to be parents. It was very difficult, and I think that even though when I came out more in the process of getting involved in the Gay Liberation Front, we worked through a lot of those attitudes and we rejected them, obviously. But I think that, as we were saying, the legacy of that time, emotionally or psychologically, can stay with you and possibly always be there, casting a kind of a shadow, really. That sounds rather negative and depressing, but actually, in fact, sometimes I think that can be quite a positive thing, because it can remind you of the need for solidarity with people in communities or places all around the world who are still suffering from those types of oppression. And we need to work to develop and support their rights to be out and to be open.
The GLF fizzed with energy, passion and activism, which was transformative for the people emerging from a long history of discrimination and persecution. Nettie joined the GLF originally because her friend Jake considered suicide because he was gay. The GLF opened up their lives to new possibilities. She talks about what it meant for her.
Suddenly I was in something, the most exciting movement that was in the country. I'd also been part of, for instance, Youth Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament and one or two other groups, but they weren't exciting like this. This was because it was about people's personal lives. It was their own liberation. It wasn't about banning the bomb somewhere else. You know, this was about how people actually lived and what was going to happen to them. And it changed us all profoundly. I mean, we all say this, you know, we were not the same afterwards. We went through such an intense experience of, you know, of personal change and political action.
She goes on to explain that the GLF was also seen as a revolutionary movement by its members, reaching beyond equal rights for the queer community to other marginalised groups. It was about human rights and overturning many of society's attitudes and expectations.
Talk of liberation and real change in society. It was so different from organisations that I later learned about. But this was about changing society completely, about a liberation movement, joining with other liberation movements, particular things like Black Power and children's liberation and hippies, but particularly women's liberation, because we're both oppressed by sexism, that is. Homosexuals are oppressed by sexism, and so are women. And so that was an obvious link.
Frankie also recalls the excitement of walking into a GLF meeting.
When I joined, it was the most fabulous discovery to kind of come into this incredible, energetic kind of burst of activism. I mean, literally, to walk into the hall, a church hall in West London, and to just find, you know, hundreds of people there. Very exciting, buzzing with ideas. It was very welcoming. Women were in a minority, and people of colour in a smaller minority still, but I always feel it's very important that they are not left out of any accounts of that history. And there were a lot of different issues being focused on. I suppose the main kind of underlying theme was validity and visibility, and just going from shame to pride, basically.
The Gay Liberation Front drew people out from the shadows of shame, proclaiming pride in being their true selves. The GLF marched, demonstrated, and organised ZAPs, spontaneous demonstrations on a smaller scale. The first Pride March in London was on the 1st of July 1972. It was not like the parades we have today, as it was a political march driven by the need to challenge many legal inequalities. They emphasised visibility and undertook many types of activism to get the issues noticed, and finally, to get many of them addressed both in law and in changing public attitudes. The GLF inspired the growth of many new groups, which tackled homophobia in many different ways, and the community grew from its early days of largely gay men and lesbians to embrace all the colours of the LGBTQ rainbow that we celebrate today. It's 1988, and Margaret Thatcher's Conservative government has been in power for 9 years. Some Labour councils were very supportive of lesbian and gay groups, but many Conservatives, or Tories, viewed same-sex love and relationships as an attack on traditional family values and a choice which was considered morally wrong. Maggie Thatcher said this at the Conservative Party's annual conference the previous year.
The plight of individual boys and girls, which worries me most. Too often, our children don't get the education they need, the education they deserve. Children who need to be taught to respect traditional moral values are being taught that they have an inalienable right to be gay. All of those children are being cheated of a sound start in life. Yes, cheated.
As a result of these views, they added Clause, or Section 28, to the Local Government Act, made law on the 24th of May 1988. It stated that a local authority shall not intentionally promote homosexuality or publish material with the intention of promoting homosexuality, or promote the teaching in any maintained school of the acceptance of homosexuality as a pretended family relationship. Section 28 technically only referred to local authorities, the people in charge of running the education in different areas. However, teachers were afraid of discussing gay issues with students in case they might lose their jobs. Section 28 also caused many groups, often funded by local authorities, to close, limit their activities, or self-censor. So, young LGBTQ people and their straight friends lost vital sources of information and support. Sue tells us about the impact of the phrase pretended family relationships.
Pretend family relationships really work people up.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people thought, hell, if the Tories can define what a family is, okay, it's lesbians and gays first, but then, you know, single mums, divorced mums, dads, you know, who's a family? What is this word family? Family did not mean me.
Jenny talks about the impact on support from some local councils who offered a lifeline to gay and lesbian groups when many people were hostile to them. There was also a big effect on education, which lasted many years.
So they were supporting organisations that they felt, you know, were doing good or to assist their local members. And suddenly, from a council perspective, you're suddenly been told you can't fund anything that's got this. So council funding dried up. But also to education, suddenly you're not allowed to teach this. So where does that, what does that mean you do about Oscar Wilde? Does he count as gay because he was gay, or does he count as bisexual because he got married, or does, okay, we can't talk about him. And there's all the other people that you then go with. Who are we going to talk about? Whose plays are we going to show? That became something where I think until almost recently, there were teachers who were not sure of where the line was drawn on what they're allowed to teach in terms of plays, authors, influencers, people who had ideas, philosophers. What can you teach?
There was a climate of fear around the growing crisis of HIV/AIDS, which was frequently referred to as the gay plague, attaching blame to victims. Taken together with a background of nearly 20 years of increased visibility and activism, homophobia was prevalent. Lisa tells us about this.
There were a lot of cartoons that were hateful to us, a lot of hate speech, and increasing visibility brought increasing hatred. And then Section 28 happened, and very naively we thought that if we held some huge demonstrations and some stunts, which I have to say were excellent stunts, and it was the first time that lesbians had led stunts instead of gay men, you know, it actually really inspired quite a lot of other people to be more activist. But we thought that, you know, stunts and marching would win the day.
Jenny tells us about the first march to protest against the inclusion of this clause in the Act.
I remember saying to the police we wanted to get together at Temple. And I think it was something like, I'll get the numbers wrong, but Temple could only take, let's say, 6,000 people meeting there. And we told them there was going to be 8, and they said, well, you can't meet at Temple. And I just looked at him, I said, look, really, we're going to be doing well if we get 4, so I think you'll be absolutely fine with Temple. And I said it so nicely, with my nice Australian accent. And they said, yes, so we organised at Temple, and about 12 or 15,000 people arrived. And it was mayhem, and the police were horrified. And then we marched all the way down there, and as we got near Downing Street, somebody said, she's home. And
Mrs. Thatcher, of course. Sorry.
And we just turned into Downing Street and had a riot in Downing Street. By the time we got to Downing Street, I think we were probably in excess of 25,000, somewhere between 25 and 40, the numbers sort of vary. But a lot of people. And the police were not happy. They dragged me out and made me disperse the crowd. They threatened to bring the horses in. And there had been, at that point, a couple of incidences where the police had ridden their horses into crowds and people had died. They did it with the suffragettes. They were threatening to do it with us as well.
Jamie tells us how she felt as part of that crowd.
Very emotional. It was such a thing to witness. Not only the anger, but the solidarity, the love. Yeah. We just couldn't move. So we're shouting. And then I learned so much about community that one day.
In addition to the marches, women did some very high-profile activism to attract public attention. This is a report on the invasion of the 6 o'clock news by women protesting against Section 28.
While Sue Lawley read the headlines, her co-presenter Nicholas Witchell sat on one protester and tried to keep her quiet. Another handcuffed herself to a camera cable. They're protesting against a new law which bans local councils from promoting homosexuality. Miss Lawley apologised to viewers, saying, "We have rather been invaded."
Rosalind tells us about her and a group of friends who protested at the Ideal Home exhibition, a big annual event with exhibition houses to show off new design.
And then we all sort of gradually went into the exhibition, you know, not together, and just walked around, and we'd given ourselves a certain time to all sort of head towards this place, this huge house, and so we looked, and we looked at a point where most people had come out, so we all went in and locked the door, so nobody else could get in, and we ran upstairs and we unfurled this banner and yelled about, you know, stop Clause 28 and all sorts of things. And it was full, I mean, it was full to bursting. I can't tell you how many people, there were thousands. Everybody was so horrified that, and the security couldn't get in because we'd locked the door. So we went on and on and on for at least 15 minutes, yelling and shouting about Clause 28 to all these, like, people just in amazement looking at us, until they could finally get us out.
On the night the bill was finally passed, extraordinary scenes were witnessed in the House of Lords. This is a news report on the day, including the reaction from one of the peers who was in the House on the 23rd of May 1988.
The House of Lords had just voted to put the controversial Clause 28 on homosexuality into the bill when the trouble started.
The gallery was in an uproar, and then we noticed that coming down from the railings, the balcony, ropes were being thrown down and three or four young people began to scale down.
And what was the mood of the peers when they saw all this?
Well, they were absolutely stunned. Incredible. We just couldn't believe that this sort of thing was going on inside the House of Lords.
Clause 28 was passed into law and not repealed until 2003. However, in the face of this adversity, the community pulled together and hardened resolve to campaign for equality and resist further incursions on their rights. Jenny tells us what happened next.
Anyway, it's around this time that a gang of guys, six of them, met at Ian McKellen's place and put out what they call the Limehouse Declaration, the second Limehouse Declaration, which was the declaration really that said we can't let things like Section 28 ever happen again, and if we're going to stop them happening, we need to create an organisation that lobbies effectively before these things come up to stop them there, and it needs to be non-party political and effective and targeted.
So Stonewall UK was born, and many, many other organisations developed from this time to protect existing rights and campaign for new freedoms, such as allowing LGBTQ couples to adopt, to have civil partnership, marriages and much more. They are still campaigning, as there are many more issues to resolve in the community here, and there are many other countries who need challenge and support to protect the LGBT community around the world. History books record the big political demonstrations and legislative milestones which have improved the rights of LGBTQ people. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. The political activism needed to achieve these is both much broader and more personal. The birth of the modern LGBTQ movement overlapped with the growth of the second wave of feminism. The feminist slogan, "The personal is political," applied powerfully to the queer community when simply walking down the street was a political act. Trans women could be a particular target. Chrissy tells us about an experience during a political rally in Northern Ireland when she found herself in the path of a march where her English accent, added to her appearance, would have sealed her fate.
So try to blend into the background.
With all your makeup on.
And then they, before they'd even reached me, the ones at the front started to go, whoa! And they all started to wolf whistle. And I knew that if they'd started to come around and question me and I'd spoken, I genuinely could have just been kicked to death quite easily. And there's nothing I could do, I just stood there. And then suddenly from nowhere, all these policemen swooped down and took me off the streets. And I've never been... happier to be almost arrested.
For many people, reactions on the street fueled their sense of identity and passion for activism. Karen tells us about her weekends.
So every Saturday night, we were at the gay bar. We were at the Bell in King's Cross. We would walk down the street wearing leather. We would ride our motorbikes. Just your mere existence was rebellion. Just getting shouted at on the street or getting spat on or being hated, that was rebellion. But we weren't going to stop. No one was going to stop us being who we were. And that was the beauty of it.
If we look back to the start of the modern LGBT movement, in the wake of the Stonewall Inn riots of 1969 in New York, visibility and personal activism was incredibly important. The Gay Liberation Front was formed and encouraged people to come out. So many people had lived closeted lives in fear of the consequences of their sexuality being uncovered. They could lose their jobs, their homes, and ran the risk of being rejected by family and friends. Stonewall lit the fuse, but in order to move forward, develop a community and gain basic human rights, it was very important to stand up and be counted, to be visible. People began to get together in a whole variety of ways, and gathering together socially often overlapped with a political agenda. Marguerite tells us about what the early days of the GLF felt like in New York and how people got together before social media.
There were newsletters, there were posters, there were dances. Suddenly everyone was wanting to come together to celebrate the fact that there was no going back in the closet. It had really blown the lid off it. And there was so much going on in so many different ideological ways, shapes, forms, groups, what have you. People needed to gather. And these legendary dances, you know, like what we would call discos, I guess, became very much a conduit for those things. And just as politically radical as anything else, because they were very much in your face. Everyone went, everyone dressed up in a way that suited them.
Pride followed fast on the heels of Stonewall. It was the first major event where individual activists came together in solidarity to establish their visibility on the streets in a powerful way. Here in the UK, the first Pride took place in July 1972. Now we are used to this being like a street party, a celebration parade featuring all the different groups within the community and their supporters. But for many years, it was a very serious political march to win basic human rights for the LGBTQ community and took place in the face of much hostility. Peter Tatchell describes what the very first march was like.
When we conceived this idea, we were very unclear and uncertain about how many people would actually turn out. In those days, most LGBT people were closeted, and many were actually quite hostile to the campaign for LGBT rights. They thought we should keep our heads down, remain invisible. That was the best approach. Those of us who are in the Gay Liberation Front, we believed it was important to assert that gay is good and that we had a right to claim public space and have full equality and human rights. On the day, many of us were surprised, not disappointed, that we got about 700 people. We thought that was quite a good turnout. And when we marched, we found that there was virtually a police officer for every single one of us. We were hemmed in tightly on the road. The police were quite hostile. Not every officer, but many of them were overtly hostile. Some of them shouted abuse and insults, calling us poofs, queers, faggots, lesos. It was a very intimidating atmosphere. We felt that we were being treated like criminals. And indeed, of course, in law we were. You know, despite the partial decriminalisation of 1967, most aspects of gay life remained criminal.
Over time, the gay community became less fearful and, at least in some major cities, gradually developed a network of venues and activities. Pubs, clubs, discussion groups, helplines, theatre projects, and so on. The common thread was often the mixture of coming together both socially and political in a safe space. The Lesbian and Gay Centre at Farringdon was a favourite haunt and was hugely important to the community in the 80s. Vito tells us about it.
I used to go there Sunday mornings. We'd have brunch and we'd read the papers and we'd just chat to people and then we'd done the tea dance in the afternoon, then have a drink or something, you know. And it was really lovely and there were often, you know, the lesbians would organise different events. It was also where PACE was based in the early days, the counselling, LGBT counselling service was based there. And I did some work for them because I was a trainer. So we developed some workshops for empowering women and assertiveness training and ageing without attitude and all that sort of thing. So, you know, we're doing demos and marches for various things, reclaiming the night and so on. But we're also organising ourselves into so many different groups. It was funny when I look back, you know. But we organise holidays together. There would be drumming. We'd go to drum camps. We'd camp and go away at camping weekends. And then we'd have lesbian camp. So it's a very rich and wonderful history. And to say that it was painful at times, and what you saw happen to your friends sometimes as well as to yourself was grossly unfair and hard to live with. But we had such great fun too, because we'd be, you know, like any marginalised group, when you're together, I don't know, you share that commonality and you share the laughter that goes with the discrimination or how you challenge it.
Vito rightly refers to the LGBT community as a marginalised group, but there are many components under the LGBTQ umbrella, groups within the group. They are made up of individual activists who need to be visible, explore their personal identities and come together around their particular common interests and issues. Lisa is an example of someone who was confused by her attraction to others. She couldn't even articulate as she didn't know the word bisexual until her first visit to Pride in 1992, where she discovered the bi community.
I joined groups. It was wonderful. It was a heyday of bisexual organising in London and throughout the country. There were three groups in London. There was a general bisexual group, there was a women's bi network, and there was a BDSM bi network, and I had much more connections with the women's bi group. I also had connections with the other groups, but there was a real excitement there and a true sense of community, a sense of political excitement around change, and some wonderful activists doing really inspiring people, doing really good stuff. So it was a great thing to connect with.
Likewise, it was really difficult for trans women to connect, particularly before the internet. However, it isn't widely known that many years ago, London had its own ball culture, similar to the one in New York.
And then we discovered quite early the drag balls in London. There were events at the old Alexandra Palace. Well, the drag balls were great fun. They were run mainly for the gay community. And I really enjoyed going there because you could be completely yourself, and we'd stay in a hotel in Earl's Court that was trans-friendly. And we'd go and we'd hit the shops on a Saturday morning, and people would say to me, "Jenny Ann, you can't go out looking like a model shopping on Saturday mornings." And I said, "Well, I'm going to Harrods, I don't know about you."
Activism within the LGBT community involves a commitment to visibility and a solidarity with others, which has bound queer people together. The different groups have maintained their distinct identities, cultures, interests and issues whilst coming together to campaign for their rights. This is not to say that there hasn't been disputes between groups, but this simply highlights the importance of the embrace of the community as a whole. Sarah expresses her feelings about solidarity and visibility in the wake of the support shown at the Trans Pride in the year that a transphobic demonstration by some disrupted the London Pride event.
And from that, there sprang a L with a T organisation, which was really, really supportive they came to Trans Pride for the march. And, you know, I asked them to march at the front because, you know, having visible allies is so important. I think visible allies, visible shows of support is one of the most underrated forms of activism there can be.